Okay, welcome everyone. We're here in the...
Good morning.
How is everyone?
Everyone looks fine.
They do. So we are the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We're one of a little over two dozen around the world. And we are here to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy, which is divine wisdom. And actually, Theosophy is the title for today. What is the origin of Theosophy? So rather than me trying to explain what it is now, we'll get to it. All month we're going to be talking about basically what is Theosophy. But we must mention that there are two weekly meetings, of course, between 11 and 12 on Sunday. The doors open at 10:30. And on Wednesday evenings, the doors open at 5:15. There's a library in the front of the building, which is a reference library. And there's a librarian there if you, care to ask any questions about what's in the library. And there's also a reference for the class, the Ocean of Theosophy class, which we just started last week. And we will be studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge till June. So that's that. We have a book table before the meeting. The library closes at 7:15, and the meeting is from 7:30 to 8:30. The book table is open before and after meetings, where you can buy literature at cost. You can also go online. It's pretty much all online, not everything. But we have a website, and Phoenix has a website that has even more than we do. So we have strictly depend on voluntary contributions of time, money, and service. All are needed, but there's no obligation imposed or implied by any means. We are an association of students. We're not an organization, so we do not have bylaws or a constitution or whatever. We do have this wonderful document here called the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. And just a couple of points in it. The work we have on hand and the ends we keep in view are too absorbing and too lofty to take the time or inclination to take part in side issues. So we're about unity, not divisiveness. So we don't get into the hot button topics. So we welcome, this was actually kind of radical when it was written over 100 years ago, but now it's rather common. We are engaged, it regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity. So we make no distinction as to race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And we like the word condition because that covers everything. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So without further ado, we will have two short talks, and then we will have questions and answers and discussion. So we just wanted to mention that, of course, we mentioned already that we're talking about various aspects of Theosophy and the Theosophical movement all month. We wanted to explain the title, The Origin of Theosophy, and we like to look up words which we all know, but there may be something a little deeper when you look in the dictionary or thesaurus. So origin comes from the Latin to rise. For something to rise, it denotes a starting point. And original is the first in time or new, fresh, novel to come into existence. So theosophy could be called the wisdom of things divine through metaphysical study and observation. So this month, the next 3 weeks, we'll be examining the theosophical movement, the historical aspect, historical landmarks will be next week, followed by the three objects of the theosophical movement, and we'll cap the month off with the timeless message of the theosophical movement. So, when we talk about the origin of theosophy, it's timeless, actually. It's, there is a modern theosophical movement, and we won't be discussing the origins of that today, unless the second speaker wants to. But we'll be talking about, where did it come from? And it came from, there are those who are the keepers of this wisdom, of this knowledge, which is, it's the knowledge of man, it's the knowledge of nature, it's the knowledge of all the aspects. It's a knowledge that comes forth periodically during periods of manifestation, and then during periods of pralaya. There aren't conscious beings, so in a sense it goes into rest, but there is always, in a sense, a consciousness, which is deity, which exists during periods of manifestation and periods of pralaya. So there are those keepers of the knowledge which are known as the divine initiates, the mahatmas, and the elder brothers. They are, theosophy postulates, and we have no dogmas, so we postulate that there are that man is a perfectible being. So there are those elder, we call them elder brothers, and really sex doesn't really enter into it because it's sexless, but they have perfected themselves in prior periods of evolution, just as we are in the process of perfecting ourselves now. So we are, the idea is that there is perfectibility. There's not, we're not defective or poor, miserable sinners. We may not, in a sense, have advanced all that much in the past 1,000 or 2 years, but it's a slow process. So theosophy is that knowledge which its point is everywhere and its circumference is nowhere. Now, we are seven principal beings, and we're concerned with the three higher principles of Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. Atma being spirit, Buddhi being spiritual soul, and Manas being mind. That's where the term man comes from, Manas, or mind. So that is, there's a process that's called the lighting up of Manas. And this was done actually millions of years ago, but when the forms were ready, when the mindless beings were ready, it was time for the incarnation or the lighting up of Manas, which means that we became self-conscious choosers of our destiny. And these were the divine kings and initiates that are in legend. And so we were instructed in all the arts and sciences, and that was all impacted into our nature. So there was a time of learning when all the arts and sciences and philosophy was inculcated in us. And there was one world religion, and mankind was of one lip, as it were, as one lip and one tongue. That it was, and we can see this throughout the tracings all over the world, and the different symbology and the ancient cultures, which we keep discovering, that this knowledge was diffused. But there came a time when they had to leave the scene, because we learn by self-induced and self-devised means. So those great teachers, those perfected beings, they moved on, and it's up to us now to, through trial and error, to learn the lessons. We wanted to read a couple of quotes. There was, during the youth of mankind, one language, one knowledge, one universal religion. When there were no churches, no creeds or sects, but when every man was a priest unto himself. That's from The Secret Doctrine. And the whole world was once nurtured under the protecting shadow of the same tree of knowledge. So that's from our divine ancestors. So that's the part of the origin. There's really, in a sense, there is no origin, because it always exists. There's just a periodic manifestations. So in our finite minds, we think of origin, but deity is, it's omnipresent, it's eternal, it's immutable, it's omniscient, and we are dealing with our minds, which are aspects of that. We are all rays of that, but we are not that in its totality. Okay.
Theosophy is impacted within our very nature. We are, in fact, beings of light. That's the reality. But we have lost that concept of reality. We are blinded by the darkness and by the shadows. The fact that we are divinity makes us, or therefore within us, is the potency to be perfected. We are told that theosophy is really godly, divine godly wisdom. But we stop and say, God, well, what does the theosophist mean by that? Well, it's not what the world religions hold as being an anthropomorphic outside God. That there is that which is, was, and always will be. That is eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. It dwells in everything, in all of matter. But the culminating activity of evolution is manhood. Not just being a man, but being or woman, but a self-conscious man or woman, where we take our place as an active worker with the law. And that law is of harmony, of universal brotherhood, of unity, because this abstract deific principle, this God, is everywhere in everything. It's like space, unchanging. When we consider it, we are that. We are that. So nothing else is really important to the sense of where is our consciousness centered? On the physical world or on the spiritual world? They're not separate, but you can't be in both at the same time. One has to, it's like noise and quiet. They both don't exist together, but separately. The origin of theosophy? Well, we think that our curiosity was probably spiked by someone else, something else, some other ideas that were out there and that were held up in Western civilization as being the important ideas of our existence. But these ideas have always existed, and we see traces of them in every religion, are these ancient ideas. They're found everywhere. It's what preserves religions, is that truth that they embody. But what corrupts religion is the personal development that it becomes. Theosophy is universal. And therefore, how do we say impersonal? It affects everyone alike. And it gives everyone the same possibility and potential to experience a conscious life in existence. But it's not a gift given man, but we must struggle to achieve that. And we do that by keeping these ancient ideas alive, that we are ever perfecting ourselves. So a process of change or re-becoming. Reincarnation is the vehicle for our progress, driven by karma, by our own actions. We create our own world, collectively and individually. So the challenge is to recognize that which is real from that which is not. So theosophy offers us ideas or perspectives that we can use to discern for ourselves what is real and what is not real. And we are told that theosophy does not take us outward, it takes us inward, to the true center of our being, the place of solitude and peace, that place where nothing changes, where everything is eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. There is that place, because we are part of that. We are an aspect of that. We just need to know that. So the time that we spend in these bodies really determine our lives to come. That nothing is cast aside. Everything comes back to us. So here we find ourselves in the 21st century. A time of great psychic activity, of great materialism. But the opportunity for spiritual advancement is greatest during this period, during this age of Kali Yuga. So take advantage of it. By studying theosophy, you are studying the accumulated wisdom of the ages. What you do with it is your choice. That's why we each are different, but the same. We have developed personalities, individualities, and now we are told we must let them go. They are not as important as we think they are, as we want them to be. So, we are told to garner unselfishness and then selflessness. And that the path that every pilgrim takes is outlined in the Bhagavad Gita. How to live your life so that you in turn will create a better reality. Because we do create it. So we need to elevate our thinking. We are living in an age of great materialism and psychism. Our feeling nature is hypnotized by the astral light. So to safeguard ourselves, come to realize that we are divine beings. We are witnesses of all that is going on. We have choices to make, to act or not to act, to listen or to talk, to help or to hinder. We talk constantly or choosing. Theosophy shows that there really is no choice. We are all one. And what we do for everyone, for the all. That is the attitude that is engendered in the Bhagavad Gita, and one which we must engender in our own heart. Just, you know, we have seen evidence of theosophy all through the ages by great minds. Plato's, Pythagoras, Orpheus, Plotinus, Ammonius Saccas, Confucius, Lao Tzu, Icarus. Now there's many have expounded this philosophy. Paracelsus, Jacob Burma, so we could talk all morning, but enough said. Yes.
So from what was said, if its origin is a rising up, theosophy rises up within us, the self-conscious thinkers, because it's always there. And when it first arose on this planet, when mankind, humanity rather, became self-conscious thinkers, but then it was said, once the ideas were implanted, those beings left, and now we are on our own. Are we?
Well, only in one sense. We're on our own because it's time to learn our lessons. But there are those there always are the elder brothers that work sometimes actively and sometimes behind the scenes. But there were beings that did leave because they have work to do on other planes and other planets. But we have it all in us. So we have to learn through trial and error by falling into matter, because there's involution and then there's evolution. And we reached the turning point. We came from spirit, we're returning to spirit. But there are great, there are teachers that act, they can act with a body or outside a body. There's a class of beings known as Nirmanakayas. We have a lot of help, but as far as being sitting at the best way to put it is our childhood is over. We were children then. We were really innocent children learning at the master's feet. But we will never make the lessons ours. You know, we need to graduate. We need to take that knowledge into the world and apply it. So it was unapplied at that point. So the active instruction, it needed to come to an end. Otherwise, we would have been, we'd still be children. We'd still be, and maybe that's what, you know, maybe that's a good, it was a good feeling at one time, but.
Maybe, yes. Well, the question was, again.
Are we alone?
Are we alone? We are told that the power of thought and ideas rules the world. So when we think of these ideas, we attract like-minded souls. That's how we found ourselves here. It is power, but it's a power which is not recognized by the masses. It's a power of truth that will set everyone free. And that each one of us, we have to garner by discrimination. And that's the faculty which we need to develop. Discrimination. Check, test, and verify.
Could we have the first speaker read that phrase or that sentence that had to do with there was a time when we were all of one language?
There was, during the youth of mankind, one language, one knowledge, one universal religion, when there were no churches, no creeds or sects, but when every man was a priest unto himself. That's from The Secret Doctrine, Book 1, page 341.
So, kind of interesting, it seems like the story of the Tower of Babel is an echo from that ancient teaching, and we wondered if there are some correspondences that we could investigate about what's going on there and what the story is in the Tower of Babel and what's going on with us now. Are we ready for one language to have it yet, or would we just build another tower without having grown up enough to handle it?
Well, it's not so much an actual spoken language that we need. We need the language of the soul. There have been attempts such as Esperanto, which there are still speakers of, which was tried to become a world language people could meet and converse in. One could argue in the computer age especially that English is becoming a worldwide language. But here's the thing. English is a very poor language for metaphysics. It's the language of the soul is what we need.
Well, there is a language that exists that we have no inkling of. That if you've been trained in these occult sciences, you've taken vows and you've become the Chela, that there's a Sanskrit or Pali or ancient languages that are expression of spiritual elements of our being, of that unseen world which we don't even talk about. But you know, Sanskrit is the expression of this. So if a learned man who has understood his early teachings, that when he's in the presence of any text, of any language, that the ideas are still passed on. So there does exist that language, but it takes a finer perception. It's sort of like time slows down.
Seems like it's slowing down right now.
Well, I think I just stopped. But we talk about Pythagoras and Plato and all these great philosophers like Plotinus, Porphyrus, their volumes, Bacon, and there's you know, Shakespeare, all these influences of this divine religion, this God, divine godly wisdom. Yeah, it's contained in Shakespeare. It's contained in many great works. See that?
You spoke earlier about man being perfectible. Just what does that mean, man is perfectible?
Well, what does it mean to be perfectible? Can man perfect himself? Can we imagine being perfect? What does that mean? Well, that's why when we study together, the first topic we take up is this idea that there are those who have perfected themselves. There is a system of perfectibility. And it was held and safeguarded by the Brahmins. And it was their last vestige of secrecy that they gave up. And they gave it up reluctantly. And that is the Bhagavad Gita. It's their most sacred book. So,
the only caveat to that would be, and it's not something we have to worry about too much or think about too much.
Then let's not do it.
No, we like to.
We like to what?
Don't we want something to reach for? Don't we want to?
Yeah, that's why we're given the idea of masters and perfected
exactly,
beings.
Exactly.
Yes.
So perfectibility is relative. It is
not
relative.
Is my relative?
Not your relatives.
Okay.
Not my relatives.
Well,
that
could.
But
be.
It is.
It could be, right?
It could be. Yes.
Yeah,
we're all perfectible. but there are periods of evolution. Okay, if absolute perfection were possible, think about it. Evolution would stop at a certain point, and it can't stop. It goes on and on and on. We can't imagine how it goes, but if we are to posit that we always were and we always will be, then there always needs to be a goal for ourselves. So perfectibility, you know, once you get a PhD, does that mean that's it? We can't learn anymore? Is that the end of learning? Ironically, or strangely, in the late 1800s, there were actually those academics that said, yes, we've learned everything. Which is so absurd, they actually think they reached a point where they knew everything. And they sure acted like it.
Sounds like an opinion to me.
They did act like it.
Yeah.
They did. It is my opinion.
That's
and that was their opinion.
So what was the question again? Who asked that question?
Perfectibility.
Perfectibility.
Is it possible?
The only example we have are masters. That they do exist. And that they're not a figment of our imagination. We do not, they have not survived in the West, but they have survived in the East, because these ideas are still prevalent. These ancient ideas. So, yeah, man needs something to aspire to in his God-like nature. We have goals physically, but what about our spiritual goals? Who are we truly but spirit in the very back?
So, to follow up on the previous question then, when a soul reaches that point of being a master, then where do they go from there?
Well, gee, what do you think? You think it all stops and everybody falls off the edge of the universe? You know? No. Reality is ever present and ever moving, ever expanding outward until the point in which it begins to contract. But we're expanding from within outward. That answer anything, or is it just make more questions, right? That's good.
Jen?
We're thinking of words like harmony and balance and justice. Is there a balance or a harmony that we have with all of us?
We do. That's what we're trying to find. Each one of us, our health, our vitality, our clearness of perception, you know, we're always trying to facilitate the opportunity for activity on this plane. And we do that amongst each other. We share in ideas. And we check, test, and verify against our own nature.
Well, there is harmony and there's discord. There are two different sides of the same coin, just like good and evil, right and wrong. We need that opposing force to come back to the center, to find our spiritual center. Yes, there is harmony. If things get too bad, when things get to such a point where they're so degraded, then mankind is never without a friend. another teacher will come on the scene and try to get us back on track.
Or a great cataclysm.
Great cataclysm.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, something like that. The earth will shake us off again.
Like Atlantis, they got out of balance. The Atlantean continent sunk to the sea. Yeah, we are them. It's true. There were remnants that were saved, and they went to the different corners of the earth. But nature will take, if we don't take care of nature, nature will take care of us.
The second speaker, one of the statements that was made is that man is divinity. That man is divinity. And where we've read that, also in the philosophy, we also have read that divinity is acquired. So we were wondering, to reconcile those two, well, we already are divinity, but divinity is acquired. Would that be related to the process of perfectibility? And so if we're not perfect yet, then we're not fully divine, or how does that all work?
Well, it's an evolution. Moving forward, it says that inherently in our very nature, we are moving back toward the source, and that's light. We are being drawn back. We are told that we have come to the bottom of the cycle, and we are again reascending into spirit, so that we're on a journey, and each incarnation is the consciousness that we have acquired up to this point on this journey. Now, what do we do with that consciousness here and now?
Go ahead.
I'm here because I thought. Yes, well, we think HPB said, I need to get people to think, just to think. And what do we know? Each generation is thinking less about these ideas and more about material ideas. That's why these ideas need to be expressed openly in public, so that everyone has an opportunity to hear them and to choose for themselves.
In order to grasp the philosophy with any degree of proficiency, one should acquaint themselves with the three fundamental propositions of the philosophy of theosophy. And these are answers to the great questions of, you know, who am I? Why am I here? Is life fair? Why is this happening to me? Generally speaking, it's reverses in life that get people to ask these questions. more rarely, people who live a charmed life and wonder, why is all this good stuff happening to me? But that can bring people to, that can also bring people to philosophy, because they may satiate themselves to such a point where it's like, there's got to be more somewhere. So it doesn't necessarily take a tragedy to bring one to the philosophy. It could also be great luck, in a sense. But we say there's really no such thing as luck. It is our karma. And that's the second fundamental, is karma. The first being deity. The second being law, which is karma and reincarnation. And the third being evolution. So we come from one source, and then we have a journey, which seems timeless, of incarnating again and again and again in these bodies to try to learn our lessons. And evolution is hope. Karma and reincarnation is hope as well. There's not an eternal damnation. There's periods of activity and periods of rest. There is suffering. There is joy. But we are mind beings, and we are educating ourselves through study and otherwise. And that otherwise can also be the school of hard knocks. That's often the only way we learn.
The question was?
Three fundamentals.
What do you mean the three fundamentals?
Three fundamentals of the philosophy of theosophy. What are they?
And you just told them that?
No one can give a complete answer.
Well, that's.
I'd like to hear you.
Well, I think.
Let's hear what you have to say.
No, I think you said it all. You know, we are given guidance. We're always given guidance. We just have to be willing to accept it. We have to be willing. We have to be wanting to know it. So the philosophy is all these little treasures that if we are looking, we find about our own natures. We must know ourselves before we can know anything else.
Go ahead. Did you want to?
You have a short question?
No, he's pointing out. Yes.
A lot of things has been said about finding out what the origin of theosophy is, the looking within, meditating, and through our experience in life. But where does study actually fit in there? Is it really necessary? The study isn't enough to hear these ideas and try to apply them in our lives? We really have to make that effort. Since it's already known, why do we have
to? I know. But we need to build up in ourselves a new perspective of the world. Because the world in which we live, we have said, this is not the world in which I want to live. Theosophy gives us a picture of another world that we can create. And when it's in opposition to the realities of the day, the resistance is strong. So we need to study. We need to keep the ideas alive in our day and daily activities. Study affords us the opportunity to keep our minds active, because they will dart off in any direction. We need to learn concentration. And we need to be centered, self-centered. So it's a process. You speak of it as if like you're there. No, it's always a striving for, always making it better. And it comes to the point where it's not only you, but it's everyone. Because what you do affects everyone.
So we have, we're told unity, work, study. So we are the United Lodge of Theosophists. When we study, we're touching other minds. We're touching great minds. Because there's an expression, people your current in space, that it's in the astral, which is all around the earth. It's an atmosphere in a sense, but it's also full of dangers and perils and all of the worst of humanity. By study, we're cutting through that. We're making an attempt to make inroads into spreading and broadcasting this philosophy, which is sorely needed and was not able to be taught openly until about 150 years ago. It was suppressed under pain of death. There were many who died. There are many martyrs who died trying to spread these spiritual ideas. And we need to learn to think for ourselves. Just don't take everything in and accept it as its gospel truth, we'll say. Because it won't last. It's like cramming for a test. When we cram for a test but don't really know the subject matter, we can memorize certain things, but then poof, it's gone afterwards. We need to study and apply. It's applied philosophy. It's not armchair philosophy.
Well, when we talk about studying and otherwise in the context of the ULT, that comes along the fuller phrase of it is, for the student who is willing to fit himself by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. So it's about what can I do? So in that phrase, what does the word fit really mean?
Well, this endeavor takes great courage, takes great stamina, and it is not frivolous in any way, shape, or form. We have to fit ourselves by study or otherwise to help others. So how do we come the fittest to do that? Well, however you imagine, you must keep your body fit. You must keep your mind fit. You must keep your surroundings fit. And to fit oneself is to put oneself in alignment with these great ideas and to be able to embody them. Yes?
I wonder if that's the key to understanding human perfectibility. We are divine in nature, but we have to perfect our instrument, make it more fit to become a better instrument for that expression.
Through karma and reincarnation, that's how we do it. But once we become self-conscious, the endeavor becomes self-induced and self-devised on how we move forward.
same time we're battling this personality that is so strong that it doesn't even realize what's spiritual inside.
Well, yes, we've cultivated that monster. We have cultivated it. But we need to look at it and to examine it. We can learn much from our own nature. In fact, that's usually all we ever learn. And if we do that, it's a good incarnation. Yes?
Well, the tradition goes in one ear and out the other.
What was that?
Nothing is a little discussion. So we keep a sense of humor. And so when we discuss these ideas, and no matter how old we are, some of us have gray hair. But after 30 or 40 years, one might say, now I understand. Because they have repeated their studies and paid attention to their experiences. In other words, keeping these ideas in front of us, being the Gita, the Voice of Silence, the literature, and so forth, the term simplified stays with us. We listen to those who have been studying for many years, and their attention and their compassion for us brings to their minds certain common ideas that we're familiar with to help us understand. We made one earlier when we said, our mother asked, what's the idea? What does she mean by that? What idea moved you to behave in that way? Well, simple things like that. It doesn't matter whether you have a doctor's science or not. They appeal to something in us. So these fundamental, basic ideas.
Well, Plato said ideas rule the world.
Well,
and they do.
Is this an idea? Exactly. Every single inch.
And that is what. That is why in today's world, we have to set aside time for study, because if we just passively absorb all that the popular culture has to offer, then we're in trouble. We're being manipulated and we're being hypnotized, as was said earlier. So study is important. Put the device down. Well, you can read on a device too, but what I mean is to think.
Study theosophy and become conscious of your divine nature, your godly nature. And that's what we learn through study, self-study. Yes?
So in theosophy, how does one...
Excuse me?
In theosophy, how does one...
Look within. Look within.
It's not really an idea.
Well, it is an idea. The idea of looking within, and what are you looking at? What, nothingness? No. No. We haven't. We come up with ideas and we expand upon them, like brotherhood. What does that mean? Can we meditate on that? Can we meditate on space? Can we meditate on ideas such as reincarnation and karma? But the meditation is finding that quiet space and letting all the activities of this life pass by. So we probably could talk more after class, but our time is up here. So we would just like to extend an understanding that this lodge is carried on or
sustained
or operated on voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. And all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.